So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review,
we no longer live in a world of black and white. Rather, the landscape has become a canvas of muted grays, where good is indistinguishable from evil, and renegades receive a hero's embrace. For nearly a decade, Bret the Hitman Hart was perhaps the most beloved superstar in the World Wrestling Federation. But when a stone-cold killer declared his intention to end Bret's legacy, the Hitman was perceived the villain, the unrelenting antagonist, the fan favorite. Soon anger replaced passion, arrogance supplanted a champion's pride. Bret turned his back on an entire nation and reunited the Hart Foundation to launch a reign of mayhem and destruction. Tonight in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, the paradox continues. Tonight, the prodigal sons return home the heroes, while five mighty superstars on a noble crusade become the villains. Tonight, the rogues are the beloved, the heroes the hated. Tonight, the gray clouds of disarray threaten to unleash a devastating tempest in your house.
I am so high.
Welcome to Review Away, everyone. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting here at LiveAudioWrestling.com and ReviewAway.com. Mr. Ting, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. This is very early.
Extremely early, especially for your standards, Wei. It is 9:30 in the morning. It is not late Sunday night. For a change, we are recording this in advance. And we are doing this, Wei, because I am off to Chicago in a few hours. And you were so gracious to wake up early, because you typically go into work later because you work really late.
Typically, yes. Yes, that's right. Anything for you, John. Anything.
Well, that's so kind of you. Now, before we get into In Your House Canadian Stampede, you went to a Blue Jays game last night.
I did. I saw.
How was that?
It was actually quite fun. I went with my girlfriend and... We had always talked about doing this because it just seems like a fun thing to do. I'm not much of a baseball fan anymore, but just to go to a game and, you know, the roof was open at the Rogers Center. We just bought, like, you know, $15 500-level seats. And, like,
those are the best seats, I find.
Yeah, like, the view was great. Like, I was concerned about how far it would be, but, like, the view was fantastic even just from up there. We were right behind home plate, like, second row. And it was just a lot of fun. I had a great time. And the Jays won 3-0.
Oh, wow. Who were they playing?
The Orioles.
From Baltimore.
The Baltimore Orioles, they looked really bad, actually.
Oh, that's too bad. I was out with one of my friends last night who was here this week from England. He moved there, like, a few years ago. And back when he lived here, I mean... I followed sports, like, pretty consistently and stuff. So he's talking to me about all these, like, what's the best baseball diamond to go check out in the U.S. And he's asking me about all these players. And about 5 minutes in, I said to say, listen, if it doesn't have anything to do with fighting, I don't know a fucking thing about it.
That's a thing that I've noticed. People who are fans of MMA don't necessarily translate to being fans of other sports. It's much like wrestling, you know. If you're a fan of wrestling, that does not mean you would be a fan of any other sport at all.
If you follow everything that's out there and all the stuff that's on TV, I don't understand how you have time to possibly follow anything. I could not follow baseball. There is no way I could possibly imagine watching a fucking 3-hour game every night of the week, or even just the effort of keeping up and reading up on your team and the entire league. I listen to sports radio and stuff to, you know, keep up with news and stuff, but Christ, is it tough.
Well, if you're a fan, you would devote time to it. I mean, you'd probably drop one of your other hobbies. You know, you maybe you would stop, go watching movies, or maybe even stop watching old wrestling to pursue maybe 3 hours a week to your favorite baseball team.
My last improv show, Wei, I worked in a waiting term into
it. Oh, wow.
We were doing this scene, and one of the guys who was in the scene was playing this dog, and he said he was wearing a FUBU shirt, and in the scene he was wrecking my lawn, and I said, "Don't you see this is my lawn? This is our lawn," pointing to my family. And I said, "It's for us, by us." And it got a bunch of laughs from people who actually knew what FUBU stood for. And I felt so, wow, I've got 98 cred here on stage.
You totally do. That's the, wow. So it was a dog that was wearing FUBU?
Yep.
A dog wearing, okay.
A FUBU shirt, like most dogs do.
All right.
It was a weird scene.
I would have loved to have been there. When will people get to see your improv, John? When will you make this public?
I don't know, because my team's wrapping up now, so.
What, that's it?
I'll keep everyone updated. I'll keep everyone updated, I promise.
All right, okay.
In your house, Canadian stamp.
Maybe we'll review it sometime. Maybe. On this show.
Maybe one day. And, well, can I be the guest? Because I was a participant.
You can be the host and the guest. You can interview yourself.
Yes. What were you thinking? All right. I enjoyed these In Your House pay-per-views, Wei, because they were 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. You what? Even back then, you enjoyed the fact that they were 2 hours?
No, I didn't have pay-per-view at the time, so it wasn't that big a deal. Mm-hmm. But coming back and watching this, great.
Yeah.
And as I recall, the start time of these pay-per-views back at this time was 7. So by 9 o'clock, you were done.
Well, why would they do that? Why would they start them at 7?
I think that was just their typical start time for pay-per-views during that time. It wasn't till like late 97, I think, that they changed to 8 o'clock. Might have even been 98.
I see.
So that was it.
I don't remember at all, but yeah, totally. Okay, 7. 7 and 9. What would you do? You would have to wait 2 hours for the law. Imagine that.
Yeah, would have been crazy. What would you have done in that 2 hours?
Watch a baseball game, maybe.
You could get in quite a few. You could get like 7 innings in 2 hours. Sunday, July the 6th, 1997, Calgary, Alberta. Of course, the U.S. versus Canada feud was in full swing here. And this was one of those pay-per-views, Wei, where, you know, one of my decisions to pick this pay-per-view was just the similarities people were making between this and Money in the Bank. Mm-hmm. And watching this show, you certainly got that, where the Hearts were just gods in this this part of the country.
Absolutely. You know, definitely. You have the heels here coming into their home territory and basically being cheered as babyfaces. And you got to see how the company handled that with its storyline.
Did you catch the free-for-all?
No, I didn't, actually. I know what happened, but I just skipped through it.
Because you missed a match that clearly was on par with everything else on this show. Awesome, awesome match.
Is that right?
First of all, we have Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, and Jerry Lawler on commentary. And right off the bat, Jerry Lawler is having audio problems. And I find whenever we review a WWF show from the mid-90s before the boom period, fuck, did they have a lot of audio problems on their pay-per-views.
Almost as bad as we do.
Yes. I mean, what is this? Next up, maybe they go to the...
Maybe they were doing their calls on Skype.
Perhaps. Lawler just had a bad connection and he had a commercial break. So we've got the Godwins, the heel Godwins, against the new Blackjacks, Wyndham and Bradshaw. And, of course, that I think the Blackjacks fall into the category of any tag team with the word new in it is destined to fail.
Yeah, absolutely. Except, you know, the New Age Outlaws. So let's.
They would be the only ones. But they weren't a playoff of anyone.
It wasn't like any reincarnation of previous team, sure.
The New Rockers. Yeah. The New Midnight Express.
New Coke.
New, I don't know. So the Godwins had turned heel after Henry's neck was broken after taking a doomsday device. And the announcers throughout this match, they're discussing the unique atmosphere for later tonight with the Hart family. So this must have been very different at the time, because I don't think the company would have ever experienced this kind of reaction where the heels were going to be treated like baby faces on such a big stage.
What, you're talking about the Hart family, not the Godwins, right?
The Hart family, okay, way, okay. The Hart family.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very unique angle for its time. And do you know if they actually booked the show before the angle started, or?
Oh, I'm sure they did. They booked their stuff months in advance, much like the Money in the Bank thing. I mean, that was booked months and months in advance.
Wow. Well, they certainly kind of lucked out, you know. In that
they aspect. Totally lucked out, because they had booked a bunch of shows and of Raw tapings in Canada that summer, just because business was down in the States and Canada had remained pretty strong for them. And it turned out that it was such a huge part of the storyline where you were going back and forth between the U.S. and Canada each week, and the reactions were just awesome.
Yeah, it was, it was something that's, and it still is something that's very unique and makes the shows very special. And you know what? When you have an angle and a gimmick based around where you're from, based on nationality, it really, really gets people behind your side, especially when you're, you know, when your population much smaller, like Canada is, to be main players in such a big angle. The Canadians are very people think Americans are patriotic, but Canadians are very, very patriotic, especially when it comes to anti-Americanism.
It's funny. We've talked before about how the WWF, they've never really been able to capitalize on the whole kind of putting your television show onto DVD and selling it. And they were planning to do that with the first year of Raw. And then it was just such a huge DVD. I mean, putting 52 episodes onto one DVD
set.
That is
crazy.
It is crazy. I agree with that. I think there's such a small amount that would even buy that.
Are there any 52 DVD sets that are actually out there for sale?
Well, it wouldn't be 52 DVDs. It's 52 hours.
Oh, okay. So how many DVDs would that be? Like, what is it? 6 hours a DVD? Something like that?
So you're talking about, a lot.
Well, maybe like nine or eight.
Nine discs for 1993 Raw. But I think what would be a great seller is if you took little segments of Raw's history. And I think if you were to kind of capture that summer of 97 and culminating with the night after Survivor Series 97, I think that would be – that to me, I would totally want to watch that. That relive that 97 period when you had this summer – and then going into the kind of the birth of the Attitude Era and culminating in this huge Montreal Screwjob story that everyone's aware of and actually seeing the TV at the point.
Didn't they do that? Didn't they do like the Best of Raw Volume 1 or something?
They did the Best of Raw, yeah. But I'm saying if you were to release, you know, like 15 episodes out of mid-97.
Oh, okay. What you're saying? It's like sort of like you know, like in comic books, when they release collected editions, like trade paperbacks of collected editions of certain storylines, you know.
Sure.
They would collect all the necessary editions of a storyline into one book.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Sure. I mean,
I just think that time period would, I think everyone would be really intrigued by that. And I would love to go back and watch some of those mid-97 episodes of Raw, because I remember as a kid watching them, like each week they were, you could really see the momentum shift, even though Nitro, they were doing tremendous numbers at the time, but fuck, was Raw the better show at the time, I thought.
I feel like, you know, maybe not necessarily whole episodes of Raw, but like just the segments, just the necessary, the important segments of a storyline. Yeah. You could just sell, you know, the Brett versus Sean 97. Oh, I guess they're doing that. But, you know, just a certain classic storyline. Although, I guess when you look at how many are there actual, I guess how many, I just worry that, you know, if they do ever do that, once you start seeing every little angle that leads up to a match, there'd just be so many logic holes, especially for, you know, angles that we see today. Anyway.
You could air the interview Michaels and Brett did where Michaels made the Sunny Days comment, and then you could get Sunny for alternate commentary to explain.
Yeah, sure. What was your reaction?
Well, all right. This morphed out of the Godwins and the New Blackjacks.
I don't know how. I thought we were talking about the Godwins here.
And the unique atmosphere at the Saddle Dome.
Uh-huh.
And Jerry Lawler had the best comment of the entire pay-per-view on the free-for-all way, because Vince was talking about how we're going to have a very pro-Canadian audience, and Lawler yelled at him. He said, "Of course they're going to be pro-Canadian. They're Canadians."
Mm. Yes, absolutely. Well, maybe certain people are self-hating.
They show Stu, Helen, and Georgia Hart in the front row. The rest of the family hadn't made their way yet. And our favorite Hart member, he would be front and center during the main event. Very, very slow match. Wyndham goes for a vertical suplex, but Henry kicks Wyndham, and then Vinnius hits a small package for the win. This was by far the weakest match on the entire card.
I don't even consider this part of the card, which is why I
just to warm everyone up. But isn't the point of the free-for-all to kind of entice people to buy?
Yes, it is. Yes. Well, you can't.
Yes, you don't.
You can't. You can't give them your best match. But you know what? That Leonard Garcia and Chan Sung-jung was on a free-for-all type of show, and I guess that seemed to work. So maybe they should have. Maybe they should have put some, you know, good cruiserweight on this show.
This was not Garcia and the Korean Zombie.
It was not.
Otis and the Blackjacks. So then we go to the opening video of the pay-per-view, and it's with their old voiceover guy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Talks really deep.
The movie voice guy.
Yeah. I never liked him.
Why?
He just, I don't know. Maybe it's because it was like a down period for the WWF, and I associate that voice with like the lean years of the company. Yeah. But I was just not a big fan
of the World Wrestling Federation, for over 50 years, the leader in sports entertainment.
And they'd always give these elaborate openings with these grand thematic, you know.
Yeah, they were
entrances. And,
you know,
we live in a world of black and white.
Rather than, you know, how they do it now and how they started doing it in the 2000s and late 90s, they now they just really use the voice of the scripts, like of the promos themselves. You just take clips from the promos to piece together a story. Here, it was all about a guy with a script reading a VO, kind of setting the scene. And, you know, like for this video, I thought it was just looking at the script and the prose here, I thought it was very well written. Whether or not the style is effective, I can say that it probably won't be effective today. Back then, I don't know. I definitely like the new style that they do better.
Well, it basically, the video was about the world not being black and white anymore, and they show the turn of Bret Hart, who was loved by everybody, is still loved by a certain audience, but has turned on the Americans, and it definitely set up, you know, the story here of Bret Hart.
Yeah, there's actually some good lines here. The guy says, "Tonight heroes will be villains, villains will be heroes," and that's definitely what they expected.
It was more his voice that turned me off rather than what he was saying.
Okay.
All the announcers are dressed up in cowboy outfits, and Vince introduces us to the show. He looks to Jim Ross and he says, "Tell us about this great Japanese match coming up." Come on, Ross. You're up on all those Japanese guys.
Oh, thank God.
So Jim Ross talks to us about tonight's upcoming Japanese match with the great Sasuke, who for tonight became the great Sasuke, taking on Taka Michinoku.
Yes, that's right. Can you not say what's the proper way to pronounce it?
Sasuke.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It is
Sasuke.
Sasuke.
It's like phonetically.
It's like a Japanese person calling you John Pollock. Porok.
Or calling you Wei Ting.
Which would be correct.
Yep. Your name isn't hard to mess up, I don't... Oh, it is. The first name is hard.
Yeah, I get Y. Y a lot. Wayne, Y, Wade, all that shit.
I now do sympathize with when people bug you about your first name. And I, because whenever I hear people now make jokes to you, I cringe. And I apologize now for how much I did it back when I first met you.
Yeah.
Well, it's really annoying.
It's all right. It's not that bad. I take it as
a lot of the jokes people make, though, they're terribly lame.
Oh, I know. And they know that they're lame. And you know what? Most of the time after people make a joke like, I see.
No way.
Yeah. Some shit like that. Yeah. They do that. They always afterwards apologize because they know how lame it is.
I thought call waiting was at least clever.
I like that. I like that, actually. I liked it a lot.
We go to our first matchup of the evening, Triple H against Mankind. And they air a video recapping the feud where, right off the bat, Vince McMahon is calling one of his matches. And he says the words, "Has Hunter ever tried to buy the WWE?" Which is just funny considering the current storyline, right? Where he basically owns the WWE.
Pretty much.
They air footage of the King of the Ring from the prior month where Hunter won the King of the Ring after China attacked Mankind with a steel scepter and then beat him down with the crown. And that's pretty much the setup for this match where Mankind attacks Hunter right at the get-go, hits a short-arm DDT, and then does the Triple H pose for him right in the middle of the ring. This is still when Hunter was the aristocrat, right before he was morphing into the DX Triple H later that year.
Yeah, what month? How far after this did they actually form DX and Hunter drop?
I think it was October, so just a few months later. Yeah. Hunter's thrown into the corner, goes to the floor. Man, the influence of Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair on Triple H was so evident in this match.
Absolutely.
Hunter teases walking out, but Mankind stops him and hits a vertical suplex onto the ramp. Then Hunter goes for a sunset flip from outside the apron, but Mankind blocks, goes for the mandible claw, but it's broken after China hits Mankind with a forearm. This was really interesting because at this point in time, none of the guys wanted to sell for China, and Mankind was one of the only guys who was willing to sell for her.
Yeah, cool. Good for Foley. When did they begin acknowledging? Because JR here, he started referencing... he referenced Mankind's elbow drop off the apron as one of the holdovers from his Cactus Jack days. So at what point did they reference that, you know, this guy was used to be Cactus Jack?
I think it had just been a few weeks before this that they did those sit down interviews with Jim Ross that kind of turned Mankind into babyface.
Yeah, and also acknowledging that there's somebody else under that.
Yeah, and I remember in those interviews they showed clips of the King of the Death match.
Yep.
So referencing Cactus Jack, and this would build up to a Raw in September where he would actually bring out Cactus Jack in the WWF.
Right. Okay. So, cool.
Anyway, the matchup continues. We see an Irish whip reversal by Hunter that sends Mankind into China, who then hip tosses him into the steps. If you wonder why Mankind has a hard time, or Mick Foley, getting around these days on his knees, these kind of spots would be evidence of why.
Yeah.
Landing right on the steps.
Yeah, it's a really crazy spot. And I'm sure, it probably looks a lot worse than it probably is. Otherwise, I doubt that he would do it all the time. But
it's a cumulative effect. I mean, that spot was one he took quite a lot throughout his career. So Hunter works on the knee that had been injured. He applies the figure four. Mankind reverses it. Hunter gets to the ropes. Then Mankind counters the pedigree, but then gets kicked into the corner and falls onto the groin of Hunter, which was another flare spot that he would always incorporate into matches. Hunter's put into the tree of woe, but he's helped up by the official. Mankind hits a pile driver and then a clothesline that sends both of them to the floor. And Mankind grabs a chair, but China stops it, and Hunter attacks the knee with the chair. China clotheslines Mankind. And this is when Vince said that Mankind is getting it from both ends. Should be a foreshadowing of China's career.
Yes, that is very correct.
Mankind getting it from both ends.
Oh, boy.
Hunter gets crotched on the top. mandible claw by Mankind, but then China grabs the leg of him and crotches him on the post as they fight on the floor, and they're brawling on the floor. The bell is called, and they fight into the audience, and Hunter is hip-tossed into the penalty box. China follows, and they continue to brawl as the officials try to break them up.
Mm-hmm. I thought this was a, you know, this was a pretty good match, but there is just so much interference here that was too blatant and not believable. I understand that was the point to, you know, put heat on China and Hunter, but there were just so many times here where I thought the interference was done really sloppy, and it just made Corderas look really dumb, more dumb than a referee even usually looks.
Poor Jimmy.
Not one of
obviously the plan was they were going to a cage match for the next pay-per-view, but this was pretty much just the story was the ring could not control these two.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a show on a second match that was leading up to another match. That was fine. It was good.
We get a video of the Calgary Stampede that was going on at the same time. Very smart on the WWF's part of booking this pay-per-view the same week of the Calgary Stampede, where you're getting so many people in the city that week that it's just, you know, maybe not smart counter-programming, but I mean, it's I thought it was smart.
I think
just so. Positioning it when so many people are in the city, and it was a big deal in the city having this pay-per-view there on top of it.
Sure. I'm sure the two kind of go hand-in-hand. And you know, after stampeding for the day, why not visit
stampeding?
Yeah, why not go to your wrestling show at night?
Have you ever been to the Calgary Stampede?
I have not. I've been to Calgary once, and that was with you. Like
yes,
for the Bret Hart.
We did not do any stampeding while we were there.
No, I didn't even see anybody with a cowboy hat. I was quite disappointed.
We were just trying to get rights to Stampede.
Okay. Yeah, were we? Oh, yes, we were. Yeah, for the documentary, yes.
And they showed the Stampede Parade featuring floats, including a WWF float, and they showed Diana Hart Smith named Miss Stampede. Miss Stampede.
Hold on, was it Miss Stampede or was it Mrs. Calgary?
I heard Miss Stampede.
Oh, okay. Because later they keyed her as Mrs. Calgary, Diana Smith.
It's not, because this whole parade was done for Stampede Week.
Okay.
The Calgary Stampede.
Well, Miss Stampede.
Well, what was funny was they called her Miss Stampede and then immediately said, of course she is the Bulldog's wife. So could she be eligible for Miss Stampede if she's married?
You know what? I think they said that she was.
They called her Mrs. Stampede later, or Mrs. Calgary later in the show.
I think they said that she was named Miss Stampede, like in the 70s or something. I think that's what they said.
We're looking way too much into this.
Let's look up the Miss Stampede history.
All right.
Do it.
I'm going to. They also showed a Bret Hart autograph session and said that the voiceover was Doc Hendricks saying that fans were stretched a mile long. And I just thought, you know, you're in Canada. Could you not have said like 1.6K?
Miss Stampede. Miss Stampede. There was also a WWF Superstars tug of war contest. I don't know if you caught that.
A tug of war.
Yeah, where a lot of like I think you had like Animal and Hawk and a bunch of other guys compete in the tug of war against some regular folk, and the Superstars won. They kick their asses with their juiced up bodies.
Allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jenny Chow is Miss Stampede in 1958.
Okay.
But
that's all. Type in Diana Hart. Let me type it in. Diana. Miss Stampede.
We should have had Diana on the show. Clarify this.
Yeah. We'll talk. Yeah, just the whole interview about Miss Stampede. All right.
She was also the 1997 Mrs. Calgary Stampede.
Okay. So there you go. There you go.
Okay, let's try Mrs. Calgary Stampede. I think this was a bullshit title.
Well, there's something to it. I'm sure there's something to it.
Miss Calgary Stampede.
All right, whatever. I'm kind of done with this.
I like answers when I have questions. God damn it.
I don't know if I'll ever find it, to be honest.
All right.
It's the lost fact.
Anyway, did you catch here, Way, while Bret Hart was walking around in some like barn area or something, did you see Paul Jay and his crew shooting him?
I did not, actually. I did not.
Yeah, he did make a brief cameo here.
All right.
Then they go to Doc Hendricks with the Hart Foundation. Before they can cut a promo, Steve Austin comes in trying to interject, but is stopped by officials. And Bret says he doesn't want to attack them 5-on-1. They're going to wait for the main event when it is even.
Mm-hmm.
So playing the baby faces here in Calgary.
Yeah.
Up next, we had Taka Michinoku against the great Sasuke. And Vince McMahon put over Sasuke tremendously by saying, "And this is the guy legends are made of. So we are told."
Well, what if he shit the bed here? What if he gave a really bad performance? It would hurt Vince McMahon's commentary credibility.
Ross also stated that Sasuke has a, quote, tremendous cult following in Japan.
Yeah.
Cult following.
Well, hey, come on. That whole country, those people are a cult.
Yeah. Japan. They're very tiny.
Yes. It's Taka is 23 here, and I think so still weird to see this match on a WWF show. You know, it's still hard for me to believe that Vince would take a chance like this to put two guys from a Japanese independent company on their pay-per-view show in a 15-minute match.
Yeah, this is just 3 months after Barely Legal that Taka worked and Sasuke was supposed to work.
Yeah.
So they cut to Mankind and Hunter fighting in the arena. Hunter's bleeding, and Vince yells during this voiceover, "And there's another receipt," as Mankind punches him. And they fight under a barrier as the match starts. And during the match, Lawler brings up Muhammad Ali against Antonio Inoki, and how that the Japanese start off slow during their matches.
I thought this was actually a good bit of insight from.
I was shocked that they were bringing up something outside of the WWF,
and that it was Jerry Lawler of all people that brought it up.
Yeah, kind of a mat based match to start things off, and Michinoku worked on the left arm of Sasuke. We saw a spinning back kick by Sasuke, and then applied the half grab. There was a back body drop that sent Michinoku to the floor, and then a flying kick off the top that misses Taka, but Taka still sold it. Then there were a series of kicks to Taka in the corner, and as well as head kicks, as Vince calls for the ref to call an end to the match. But the match continues.
Stop it, ref.
This Enough. Is too much. Michinoku makes a comeback, attacking the knee of Sasuke. We see a springboard plancha to the floor. Then Taka flips over on a German attempt, and then he hits a Hurricane Rana and a roll-up for a two-count. Sasuke hits his springboard elbow in mid-ring, followed up by an Asahi moonsault to the floor, which I think was identified as like a reverse moonsault or something like that. I don't know. Or a flip to the floor. We see a running knee and a springboard dropkick to Sasuke, and then the Michinoku driver is hit by Taka. Sasuke kicks out, makes a comeback, hits a powerbomb, and then a double underhook suplex for the victory.
Yeah. It
was like a double underhook, like, into a German.
No, it was, a tiger suplex, John, is the proper term.
Well, I'm explaining it for the people who don't follow this cult country.
All right. I understand. I love this match. I mean, I pretty much love any match involving either of these two men. So obviously, it still really surprises me because these guys, you know, rather than come out and wrestle a WWE style match, they pretty much wrestled a completely Japanese style match with a very slow submission pace to start off. And it was almost surreal kind of watching this in a WWF ring with WWF commentators because it seemed like the crowd was taking to it in the same way that a Japanese crowd would. Like, there were parts of this match where this Calgary crowd was unusually quiet, but it didn't seem like they were bored. It wasn't that type of quiet. It was like the same type of attentive, focused quiet that you would usually get from a Japanese crowd.
Yeah, and you're also dealing with an audience in Calgary that I would venture to guess is kind of a more educated crowd than your rank and file city, just because of the history and guys that they've seen in there. I mean, they saw, you know, a very young Jushin Liger working at the Stampede territory and seeing this kind of style before. I gave credit to the WWF for allowing these guys to work to their strengths in this match, whereas typically you'll see guys come in and, I mean, look at Sin Cara. Yep. He's been greatly reduced in what he's allowed to do. And I think one of the best things to happen to the WWF was WCW coming in and just obliterating them business-wise, because it allowed them to, the WWF, to take chances, because there's no way this match is happening on a WWF card had the Cruiserweight division not been such a success in WCW.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Was this the match that initially, weren't they looking to sign Sasuke instead of Taka, and then coming out of this, wasn't it this match that led them to sign Taka instead of Sasuke?
Yeah, I think it was just a few weeks later they signed Taka, and they didn't sign Sasuke. And I mean, based on the finish, they clearly had to have been of the impression that they wanted Sasuke over Taka to be kind of their flagship. So just think, it could have been Sasuke turning heel and joining Kaientai to chop off Alvinus' dick.
Jesus, wow. What a loss.
When you ran into Sasuke in the subway, you could have asked him about the John Bobbitt angle.
Uh-huh, yeah. You know what? Man. That could have changed. Maybe that might have changed everything. Like, maybe he wouldn't even have gotten to politics had he been, part of something so...
From the 94 J-Cup to John Bobbitt, the great Sasuke story.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So, I really like this match. Crowd did seem more behind Taka, and maybe that was a reason for... For his
he kind of played the baby face in this match. I mean, he was kind of like, in the literal sense, he was kind of, like the young student. I mean, just getting to work a singles match with Sasuke, Taka must have been just crazy here.
Sure. Well,
working here with
they work together.
Sasuke.
But they work together a lot.
I know, but here you are in a foreign country on a major pay-per-view.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, absolutely. For both of these men, I'm sure, it was maybe their dream to perform.
I bet you Sasuke didn't give a fuck.
Okay.
I've been there, kid. Hunter and Mankind fight outside around wooden crates. There's some beer kegs, and Mankind delivers a back body drop onto a crate onto Hunter. So... Their brawl continues, Way. Now the arena cannot contain them.
Mm-hmm.
They recap the Ahmed Johnson injury from Raw, where he injured his knee and therefore could not challenge The Undertaker on this pay-per-view. And God, did this show become better as a result of it. Imagine seeing The Undertaker against Ahmed Johnson on this show.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. This guy was injury-prone as fuck.
And also prone to injure other people.
Yes. Man, this is a guy that... It's funny. Usually anyone who made any kind of name in the WWF, they're always brought back at some point. And if they're not, like an extreme circumstance, like a Randy Savage or something, people always ask whatever happened to this guy. No one ever asks what happened to Ahmed Johnson, who at one point was like, he was pushed as one of the top baby faces in the company.
Yep. Well, we know what happened to him. WCW brought him back.
It's Big T. And then I think he got arrested for pimping.
Is that right?
I think he was like pimping like underage girls. I believe. Yeah. Someone search that. I don't want to confirm that.
Yeah,
he was involved in some sort of pimping ordeal.
Good for him. Big T.
Big T. Oh God. One day we're gonna have to review that pay-per-view where he he fought Booker T for the rights to the letter T.
Oh, man.
This was WCW creative, everybody.
Yeah.
So we see Paul Bearer and Vader backstage with Doc Hendricks. Hendricks talks to Bearer about the accusations he made on Raw this past week about Undertaker murdering his own family. And then they replay the Royal Rumble finish where Vader pinned the Undertaker earlier this year. A finish from a match 6 months before, Way.
Amazing.
What a concept.
Mm.
And that leads us to our WWF title match, The Undertaker against Vader, Undertaker defending the title. Jim Ross immediately states, this will not be a Briscoe versus Funk classic.
Yeah, it won't. Well, meaning it won't be that style of match.
I guess not. I just find it's like right off the bat, you're saying this match is going to look like shit.
That's not what he means, though. He just means that this is going to be a heavyweight brawler type of match and not a, you know, a psychology heavy match.
Vince talks about the Kane angle and Undertaker supposedly murdering his family and having a lost brother. This really is an atrocious storyline when you think about it. And
quite the departure from Taka Michinoku versus the Great Sasuke.
Jim Ross brings up Vader dominating the Japanese scene at one time. So maybe he was also had a cult following.
Yes.
We see a flying clothesline by Undertaker that drops Vader. Vince says, this was the best. Says, the fans are very forgiving of whatever the Undertaker did, even if it's murder.
Yeah. There's a sign in the crowd. Somebody had a murderer sign.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and just held it up.
Maybe it was a Stampede protester of what they're doing to these cattle.
Oh, okay. I see.
Probably not. Vader's dropped to the floor with a big boot. Then Undertaker's tossed into the steps onto the floor as Paul Bearer then weakly kicks him and calls him a murderer.
Yep.
Paul Bearer was great in this match, I thought. Undertaker guillotines Vader on the top rope, hits a top rope clothesline for a two count. Vader then gets the heat and keeps Taker grounded. He goes for a Vader bomb, but Undertaker rises, hits a low blow to Vader on the ropes, then hits a choke slam from the second rope, but Vader kicks out at the last second. Then another choke slam to Vader. He kicks out, and finally, Taker picks him up for the tombstone and delivers it and gets the win here. I like this match.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was okay, but...
I always thought Vader, he never really got a good run in the WWF, but he was a guy that, when he was motivated, he could really work. Mm-hmm. And I think he wasn't as motivated in WWF when he realized his spot in the company.
The tombstone looked fantastic. I was just...
Oh, fuck, I couldn't believe he got him up so easily, and Vader didn't sandbag him or anything. Yeah. It looked really good.
Yeah, it did. It did. I thought this was an okay match, though. It didn't really stand out.
It was fine. I'm not saying it was a Funk Briscoe classic, but it was more than adequate and way better than a potential Ahmed Johnson match would have been.
Absolutely.
That would have been horrible.
Yeah.
And Vince does his typical, like, I'm going to subliminally mention the next pay-per-view and try and weave it into my conversation, and said this following set of lines. Imagine being accused of murdering your family. Does his brother really live? We may find out at SummerSlam, if not sooner.
Yeah, meaning he doesn't know. He doesn't know his own booking.
Now, as much as we talk about like Crash TV at the time, think about this, okay? Paul Bearer, the Raw prior to this show, mentioned the Undertaker killed his family. It was a full 2 months before that when Paul Bearer came out and said, I have a secret. And Undertaker and Kane, so basically April of 97 was when that secret was first stated by Paul Bearer, and they had their first match 11 months later at the next WrestleMania.
Mm.
That's kind of nuts that they were able to let that Kane storyline from his introduction to everything, like basically a year building up this one match.
Yeah, it was a different time back then.
Today, that secret would be stated at the beginning of Raw, and the guy would attack Undertaker at the end of Raw,
uh-huh.
And they'd have a match at the pay per view 2 weeks later.
They have a lot less TV. They had a lot less TV to produce back then. Less pay per views. Maybe ratings.
They had 2 hours less television, and they were still doing 12 pay-per-views a month, a year.
I guess it's an issue. They were also weren't doing as well financially as they are now. So what does that mean?
I would think that would lend you more to doing hot-shotting.
Yeah. So.
And they weren't at the time. They were being very patient.
Yeah, no, I'm saying they're... Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, we cut to another Bret Hart autograph session. More highlights of Bret Hart being a superstar. And then we went into a video. This was to set up the 10-man tag, but it was really weird because the beginning of it, it all focused on DOA, the Nation of Domination, and Los Boricuas and their feud, mm-hmm. who had nothing to do with this pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it bled into the Bret Austin feud and how this has led to a 10-man tag tonight.
I think the maybe they're just kind of talking about the formation of the Hart Foundation, and as a result of all these factions coming together.
Then we go backstage to the Wrestling with Shadows segment, where Doc Hendricks is with Ken Shamrock, Steve Austin, Goldust, and the Legion of Doom. Everyone cuts a promo except for Austin, who just walks off.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets us up for the main event. They bring out Farmer's Daughter to sing the national anthem. And this was a legitimate band. They had some hits. I had never heard of them.
Me neither.
Very Canadian choice here.
They should have got Nickelback.
They should have had Nickelback.
Are they from Alberta?
They're from Abbotsford, British Columbia.
Oh, okay.
They grew up down the street from Oro Ranallo.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Oh,
same
wait.
Street, I believe. I'm not kidding. I think Chad Kroeger grew up on his street.
Is that right? I know. Yep. Doesn't he know somebody? Don't we know somebody that lives on his street right now? Or is that wrong? Chad Kroger's street.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know where the guy lives now.
Okay, whatever.
It's now 10:30 in the morning, everybody.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Thanks for joining us. Howard Finkel announces that Premier Ralph Klein is in the front row. He gets booed.
Yeah.
Politicians always get booed, no matter what.
Uh-huh.
And then it's announced that Stu and Helen and the rest of the Hart family are at ringside, and they're wearing his aviator shades and leather jacket. Badass Bruce.
Bruce Hart, yes. Holding up his dad's hand. Huge pop for Stu and Helen.
Yeah, they got a tremendous, tremendous reaction. Mm-hmm. And that leads us to the 10-man tag. Goldust, Ken Shamrock, Steve Austin, Hawk, and Animal against Brett Owen, British Bulldog, Jim Neidhart, and Pillman. And each of the Hart team members come out individually. And just culminating with, Owen came out, you would have thought this guy was Steve Austin at his peak. And then Bret Hart came out and this place just went insane.
Mm-hmm.
The reactions here were just unbelievable here for the Hart family and Pillman.
Absolutely. It felt very, just very special and very real for not only, this audience, but the performers themselves, and I'm sure to Stu and Helen. You know, like, here's a family that devoted their entire lives to pro wrestling, and here is kind of, like, you know, almost like the crowning jewel of their success, all their hard work, the complete adulation of their sons and their son-in-laws from this audience.
It's kind of funny as well, because like when this pay-per-view and this whole storyline was happening, I was like 13 years old, and watching wrestling for as long as I had, it was like I was always a fan, but it was, you know, the top babyface, for instance, when I started watching was Hulk Hogan, you know, the guy who came out to Real American. And then, I mean, we just reviewed last week the whole Lex Luger, Lex Express thing. It's like, if you were a fan in Canada, you followed it. But it's like, they don't even know we fucking exist here in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So when this happened, it was, to me, I was just so enthralled because it was like, A, they're acknowledging that I as a fan exist here in this country that is not the United States. And it became the centerpiece of WWF programming. So it was, to me, that was a draw in and of itself.
Yeah.
Just the inclusion of Canada and something that, you know, Canadian fans could get into, a Canada versus U.S. feud.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did you agree?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, that's why I said mm-hmm.
I gotcha. Helen gets the sunglasses from Brett. And then there's a big stare down with all 10 men. And Jim Ross notes that there is a documentary crew filming Bret Hart. And he says, hopefully tonight will be a significant part of that documentary. That would be the next major pay-per-view in November.
Yeah. No, the next one. They had SummerSlam coming up.
Oh, that's right. SummerSlam was in there too. Because I don't count those in your house shows at the time. were you as much of a nerd as I was, Wei, as when the match started with Hart and Austin wrestling, all you could hear was Pat Patterson?
No. What happened? What did Patterson say?
Well, if you're going to go 40 minutes, then you start off big. You can't keep up that pace, but you start off strong, and the crowd's gonna be in it.
I didn't know Patterson.
All I heard at the beginning, and then the finish when Patterson's laying out the finish for that match.
Yeah, totally.
Brother Rosa Mob, no good son, bitch, motherfucker.
Good.
I could listen to Pat Patterson do commentary all day.
It's been a while.
I've watched Shadows way too many times for my own good.
Yeah.
So Hart and Austin start. Hart's on offense first. The crowd is reacting to anything. Like Brett could have fucking put on a rear chin lock for 10 minutes and they would have just been going ape shit here.
They cut to a shot of the hard camera and the hard cameras were shaking. It was fantastic.
Just a crazy reaction here for this main event. Yeah. They even they did a spot where Austin applied the $1 million dream. Brett kicked off the top ropes, which is the finish they did for their first match at the Survivor Series the prior year. But Austin kicks out this time. I'm always a fan of spots being used in matches that play off of prior matches.
And you'd probably be an even bigger fan if the commentators acknowledged it.
No, nope, they didn't bring it up at all.
No, I don't think they recognized it. They probably didn't know.
It was like, didn't they do that once? I don't know. Neidhart and Shamrock get into the ring. This was awesome, as they tried to emulate a shoot here where Neidhart put his fists up like he was going into a fucking K-1 bout. And Shamrock, it just looks so awkward, like Jim Neidhart here is going to shoot in on Ken Shamrock. Shamrock goes for an ankle lock, but Pillman breaks it up. Pillman, at one point here, mounted Shamrock and hit him with slaps. Owen gets tagged in, gets a huge reaction, delivers an enziguri to Goldust. Hawk is in. He gets the advantage, delivers a splash off the top to Owen, then a drop kick. Owen goes for the sharpshooter. Big reaction for that as well, but it's broken up by Animal. And then Bulldog is in with the vertical suplex to Hawk. Running power slam, Goldust breaks up that count, and then Brett is back in again. And this is where he puts Goldust in the Tree of Woe into the Hart corner, and that's where all of the Harts start attacking Goldust, and the crowd just cheers on as they beat down Goldust 5-on-1.
Yeah, and it wasn't like the Harts were playing baby faces here. They were still demonstrating all their heel tactics, clearly playing, doing the heel thing. But
it didn't matter what they did. Oh, they were not booed
at all. The more bad guy things they did, the more the crowd loved it.
We see a top rope drop kick to Animal, and then a kip up by Owen for a big response. Then he runs into a power bomb by Animal, and Hawk and Animal then hit the Doomsday Device, and it leads to everyone running in and brawling. Austin pulls Owen's legs around the post, snaps his leg on the post, and attacks him with a chair and gets into a scuffle with Bruce. Bruce gets involved here.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, was this early? Was Bruce supposed to start attacking him right here?
It was, I don't know.
It didn't seem to lead to anything.
A Bruce Hart shoot.
Yeah.
Neidhart then drops Austin into the Hart corner, and he gets mauled as Owen is helped to the back with his bad leg after being hit by Austin on the post. Pillman then gets into the opponent's corner, takes a stunner from Austin, but then Brett pulls Austin into the post and smashes his leg onto the post twice, and then hits him with an extinguisher, a fire extinguisher to the knee, Wei. And then he applies the figure four leg lock onto the post, but Hawk breaks that up. And then it's Austin who is limping to the backstage area. So it's 4-on-4 at this point. Brett and Shamrock then get in the ring. Shamrock lets Brett get to his feet for a fair fight as the others fight on the floor. And then we see a low blow to Bulldog as Shamrock makes a tag. Austin then limps back and rejoins the match. Austin gets the sharpshooter to Brett, and this is when Owen returns, so we're back to 5-on-5. Everyone goes to the floor, and Austin attacks the family members at ringside. This leads to Brett attacking Austin. Austin gets back into the ring. His back is towards Owen Hart in the ring, and he's still mouthing off to Brett and the family at ringside. He's distracted. Owen rolls up Austin and gets the win as this brawl continues. And this finish was got a huge, huge pop. And the finish of this, if you watch Wrestling with Shadows, they kind of try to explain it where basically one of the Hart members was supposed to take a beer from Stu and throw it onto Austin. Austin would turn around thinking it was Stu from that spot earlier where he got involved with Bruce, where he saw the beer and then was supposed to attack everybody. It was a little hard to digest and understand here at the finish.
Yeah, yeah. It just looked like somebody tossed a beer at Austin, and Austin, for whatever reason, decided to attack Stu instead of the guy who threw the drink. But nonetheless, you know, a very good match. I think it's very difficult to book a match like this with 10 participants, but they did a fantastic job with their frequent tags. Everything was just the pace was high, the pairings were really good. You know, they really had, you know, unique pairings, obviously with Austin and Brett, but then also little segments in between like Anvil versus Anvil versus Shamrock as sort of the shoot fighting type of deal. And even Brett versus Goldust, for instance, JR would point out how, you know, here are the two sons of two legendary wrestlers.
Yeah, very true.
So I really enjoyed the match, the way this match was laid out. And the finish was, you know, the appropriate one for the crowd. Very much.
And it was also building the Owen and Austin the next month. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Made sense. I didn't think it hurt Austin. So, really, really strong main event. Exceptionally heightened by the audience. They really made this match at the end. So, very, very solid. And then afterwards, Bruce, Ross, and Smith Hart were all in the ring. Austin runs back. He attacks Neidhart with a chair. And Neidhart's facials as he sold this chair shot were out of this world. And Austin gets beaten down by the Hart family. They're all just mauling him. And then Austin is handcuffed. He gives the finger as he leaves in handcuffs and kind of preserves his kind of baby face sort of turn that he was making at the time as kind of the anti-authority figure. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the family gets into the ring once Austin leaves. The whole family is celebrating. We even saw a super young Harry Smith here in the ring with a Bulldog.
Yeah, which, I thought I saw Tyson and Teddy in here as well.
Tyson and Teddy, I think, were in there as well. Yeah. And to date, this would be the only time Harry Smith has been in the ring after the main event of a paper.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's poor guys.
Yeah. I thought
probably don't even know Harry Smith is on the roster at this point. It's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know when the last time I saw him was. I thought the booking of Austin was pretty smart here, especially, you know, running up the ramp with the handcuffs, still flashing the finger. It made him look like, you know, the badass that would stick up to, like, to these people in enemy territory, to anybody else not watching as a Canadian. But at the same time, it worked as for Canadians too. You know, you give the home crowd what they wanted in a win for the home team, but you also in that environment managed to build this aura of this badass who, even in enemy territory, doesn't give a fuck and just attacks. They really knew the Steve Austin character by this point, and they knew how to emphasize those traits.
This was such a complex storyline to put together, where Hart was like a babyface one place, a heel the other. Like, we look back on it and it was like, oh, that was the obvious choice, and that turned around, you know, it was some of the best angles the company had put together. But it's like, imagine going to the beginning where you had this babyface in Bret Hart who had been a babyface for so long and presenting this idea. Like, it sounds insane, and they're like, how could this possibly work?
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty amazing that they pulled this off to the degree that they did, mm-hmm. And I think it's a real credit to the people involved putting together this whole storyline of how to turn Brett and Austin and play off this kind of nationalistic angle without it, you know, becoming overbooked or a Vince Russo style of angle where it would just be so confusing.
Right, right. Absolutely.
What do you think of the show overall, John?
I like this show a lot. I'm not going to say it was my favorite pay-per-view of all time. Like, I'd never seen this show in full before. I think I had only seen bits and pieces of it. Very solid pay-per-view by the standards of the time, especially for WWF. And I think a lot of people look back on it fondly just because of the whole the Hart family dynamic in the main event and everything. I would still say I enjoyed that Money in the Bank pay-per-view last week more than this.
I agree with you. I definitely do agree with you. I think this... Maybe I hyped this pay-per-view a bit too much in my mind, you know, after knowing, you know, just knowing the legendary status of it. But I think it really benefited from only being 2 hours as well. Like, I'm sure if this was a 3 hour long show, there would be a lot more garbage in there. When you look at the actual list itself, there were 4 matches, and of the 4, you had a, you know, decent match between Hunter and Mankind, but not one that was one of their more memorable, and certainly one that was definitely marred by, you know, the lack of finish. So it was just a decent match. The Taka and Sasuke match, sure, that one was fantastic, sure, as was the main event. The main event was very good, too. And then you had Vader versus Undertaker. So I can see why people were so ecstatic about this match, or this pay-per-view, because of the crowd, because of, you know, the real lack of there being anything terrible. But for what is good on the show, I still consider maybe because it's more fresh in my mind, or maybe not. But I like the Money in the Bank show better than this one as well.
I still give this one a 8.5 out of 10. I thought it was still a very, very solid show, and the crowd was just awesome, and they added a ton to this, and it was you know, I could imagine just watching at the time. If you're used to your rank and file WWF pay-per-view, and then suddenly you get a crowd reaction like this, it felt really special. And I totally see how people might regard this as maybe the best WWF pay-per-view they've ever seen. What do you give this?
8 out of 10 for me.
8 out of 10. All right. Well, that's what we thought, everyone, of the show. So let's get into your feedback right now. And we'll start things off with Aram Nasrallah. This is one of the greatest pay-per-views ever. Just loved it from top to bottom. And I was even let down when I heard Ahmed Johnson wasn't getting his shot. I have to admit, because I was a huge Ahmed mark and couldn't wait to see him as the first black champion. The main event was one of my all-time favorites. Can't remember Legion of Doom being booed ever, and the lightweight match was phenomenal. Might I suggest the first pay-per-view I ever saw, SummerSlam 92, I guess for a future review. All right.
Jordan Ducharme. I've been reading Brett's book, and I'm not this far into it yet. It's interesting, though, and makes me even more interested to hear this review. This review should be a big bowl full of good. Okay.
Josh Thomas. I didn't order this one, and I don't know why, as the Hart Foundation in 97 has gone down as one of my favorite angles. I did rent it, though. I'll never forget how they got introduced one by one, and the order they came out was just right, with the crowd being louder. And once Brett came out, holy shit, the crowd erupted. From the stare down with Austin and Brett at the start to Brett giving Austin his own version of the mudhole stomp, I did enjoy every time Austin was on the outside and would taunt the Hart family. Funny shit. And I believe Bruce got some shots in. And I liked the finish having Owen pin Austin, the baby brother getting the win in his hometown. I also liked Owen more than Brett during their feud, so seeing Owen getting this babyface reaction was nice. The rest of the card to me was so-so, but that main event also makes up for it. It definitely tops last year's SummerSlam main event with the Nexus and pretty much all the Survivor Series matches ever. And by far the best in-your-house pay-per-view.
James Williams, this is one of the first pay-per-views I ever saw. I still remember thinking it was weird seeing Goldust in the main event. But from the start, I was a Hart Foundation fan, so I enjoyed the ending with Owen getting the win. Owen316 says, "I just broke your neck." Love it.
Go to Tony Sakic. This is a show I did not watch at the time, and I didn't really think the overall card was that great at the time. Having this perception made me shocked when I had a chance to watch the main event a few years ago. The energy was amazing, and it is a show you definitely need to see to understand the hype behind. Dave Meltzer gave Punk Cena 5 stars, when in reality, it is not a technical classic, but rather a fantastic story that makes complete sense. This match is similar to that, and when I think of this show, that is the only match I can even remember, which is why it is fantastic.
Alex Stephanie. I remember this one with mixed feelings. It's probably the best pay-per-view of all time. It's a bittersweet moment to see that 40% of the talent that worked the main event are no longer with us, that they left us performances like these so we could always remember them. Thanks for bringing back memories like these. Rest in peace, Brian, Davey, Owen, and Hawk. All right.
Yes, quite a lot that have passed on. Ryan Daniels. I only discovered the product a few months following this event, so I've never seen it in its entirety. I do remember buying an issue of WWF Magazine from around this time and seeing photos and results of this pay-per-view inside and thinking how good it all looked. The matches I seemed really intrigued by at the time from the photos alone were Triple H vs. Mankind and the brawl afterwards, along with Undertaker vs. Vader. I finally saw Taka vs. the Great Sasuke on Vintage Collection recently and thought it was a good match. Also, did you catch a young D.H. Smith and Tyson Kidd in the post-main event celebration? I saw this on the Hart Family DVD last year. I look forward to the review and seeing this whole event myself one day. Yes, we did mention that. They were there in the post-match.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Cook. I can remember going to this. Being from Calgary and being a huge wrestling fan since birth, I can never recall a hotter crowd in the Saddle Dome than that night, if not of all time. It was the rise of the Attitude Era and one of the hottest storylines of all time. Even though I'm a huge Bret Hart fan, I actually was cheering for Austin, which caused a little fear because of some drunken idiots. Who gets in the face of a kid when you're in your late 20s just because he's wearing the famous Austin 316 shirt? But hey, that shirt got me the bird from Austin when he was being taken away in handcuffs. Awesome memory. That night, though, I must say Bret was not the star. It was the late, great Mr. Owen Hart. I can still hear those chants of Owen Hart, Owen Hart, Owen Hart clearly in my head. WWF Canadian Stampede is also one of the grim pay-per-views because when you look at the 10-man main event, almost half are no longer with us. But to end this ramble, I will conclude that with this show, no matter how many I see, will always be in my memory. That crowd was unbelievable, and to know I was part of it. But I'm not taking up any more of your time. You have a show to get to, so get to it.
Okay. No, we appreciate someone who is actually live at that show, and that's always great when people attend the shows and then can reminisce with us here on this show. Jeremy Gordon, I love Canadian Stampede for the sole reason that the 10-man tag main event is the most hilarious match ever. First off, Ken Shamrock potatoes just about every single Hart Foundation member in the match, including the stiff kick to Bret Hart while he's in the corner. Austin is in full-on, out-of-control, slipping all over the ringside area and falling on his ass mode, and it's great. And the shining moment is Ken Shamrock's headbutt to Earl Hebner's ass on the outside of the ring after the LOD throw Davey Moy into the announce table. After the infamous ass butt, he gets up and his hair is all fucked up from it, and it looks ridiculous. I have a friend at work, and we constantly refer to this match as Ken Shamrock's greatest hit. Yes. How did I miss this ass butt?
I missed it, too.
I might actually go back and look at that.
Mark Robinson. I'd always heard about this event, but never got the chance to see it until a few years ago. And that has to rank as one of the hottest crowds in WWF history. There was only 4 matches on the pay-per-view, not counting the free-for-all match, but none of them were bad. Foley as Mankind and Triple H had a pretty good match, ending in them brawling all over the outside in the arena in what I think is an underrated feud from 97. Sasuke versus Michinoku. Strange to see that match on a WWF pay-per-view, but it was also a pretty good match in my opinion. Taker Vader was also good. Taker was hugely over himself at the event, and I always thought Vader and Taker had good chemistry in the ring. Then of course there was the main event. The crowd pop was ridiculous for each member of the Hart Foundation, and when Bret came out, I literally had to turn down the volume on my TV. I thought Austin, while playing the heel in the match, I thought it really got him even more over as a rebellious babyface who didn't care how many people he had to take on, especially at the end when he came back to attack the Hart Foundation despite the entire family being in the ring and him still flipping off the crowd while being led away in handcuffs. Just an awesome visual. 8.5 out of 10.
Corey Ferreira, such a great event. The angle leading into this pay-per-view was great. I loved the USA-Canada war in the WWF at the time. The Hart Foundation were such great heels and did a great job portraying the pro-Canada angle, even though Bret and Owen were the only 2 Canadians in the group. Weird that the group had 2 Americans in it. The crowd for this show is is one of the best in WWF/E history. They were so hot for the Hart Foundation. Even though the event only had four matches, they were all enjoyable. Hunter and Mankind had a nice little match. I enjoyed their 97 feud and is underlooked and overshadowed by their 2000 feud. I found it weird seeing Great Sasuke on a WWF event, but him and Taka had a nice little match. I like Taker and Vader. I enjoyed the 97 title run by Taker. I also like Vader and his role in WWF at the time. Shame he was forgot about in early 98. I think he could have been a decent heel in the Attitude Era. Now the main event team, USA, consisting of Austin Shamrock, Road Warriors, and Goldust against the Hart Foundation. The crowd was so hot for this match. The star of the match is Austin. Despite the fact he was the hottest thing in the company at the time, he played the heel role well in Canada. The crowd reaction when Owen rolled up Austin is insane. I like the post-match when the Hart family all came into the ring to celebrate with the crowd just popping like crazy. I also liked when Austin came back to beat down the Hart Foundation at the end of the match, just adding to Austin's growing popularity at the time, making him more of a badass. Despite the fact that the WWF was at the time, this angle made Raw such a great show compared to Nitro's. I found this Hart Foundation angle superior to the NWO angle. They should have gave the WWF more viewers. It was that good. Overall, the best In Your House event by far and still ranks in the top five WWE shows of all time. Easily a 10 out of 10 show for me.
Atish Singh. Great show and a great crowd for this pay-per-view. I remember the Hart Foundation coming out one by one with Bret getting the loudest ovation at the end. Loved it when Stone Cold was playing heel in this match and got put in handcuffs, fingering the crowd as the fans were cheering and taunting him. Personally, I thought WWF's Team Canada vs. USA angle was a great combat to Nitro's WCW vs. NWO angle. Good job getting the two countries to choose sides with patriotism. This was really about the time WWF really started to turn the corner. Watching both companies during this time, I always felt that the WWF's main event work rate destroyed WCW's, but Nitro had a much better undercard. Too bad Bret wasn't there for the big boom period. Awesome job on all these reviews, guys. You really entertain me with your quick-witted comments and knowledge of the business. There you go. Thank you.
Jay Hunter, I was a massive fan of the Hart Foundation and 97 in general, seeing the evolution of the WWF and rising stars like Austin, Triple H, and Mankind. Bret always spoke highly of his international fan base, and the closest thing I had to a hometown hero was Davey Boy Smith. Even as a mark, I remember being shot down for telling people that Bret, unlike Austin, stood for pride and respect in the WWF. I love that technically Bret was a face, but went about things like a heel, preaching family values, but also how disappointed he was in the fans and the direction the WWF was taking. The idea that Bret's character never accepted his heel turn, but rather was a face seen in a different light, was a stroke of genius. Canadian Stampede was the zenith of the Hart Foundation. It was so vindicating, seeing them get a much-deserved hero's welcome home, much like Punk at Money in the Bank and RVD at One Night Stand. Fantastic show. Emotion like this is what wrestling is all about.
Alan,
clever.
Alan Gaynor, really great show. Best of the In Your House pay-per-views. Most people focus on the main event in Sasuke Taka, but I also love Vader versus Taker. This was around the time when they finally gave Taker quality opponents to work with, rather than the stiffs, gimmick appropriate, I guess, that he had to work with in the early years. Vader, well, he was always great. It's a shame his WWF run didn't amount to more. These two had another very good match at the Rumble earlier that year. I think it says a lot for an event when Triple H and Mick Foley are in the worst match on the card.
Brian Hillhouse, you just read Allen's, right?
Yeah.
I'm terribly bad at paying attention. Yeah. Brian Hillhouse, I just finished reading Bret's book last night, and he talks about the match on this card. Apparently, the WWF was ready to give Bruce a shot and a spot in the new Hart Foundation. But during the outside brawl, he punched Steve Austin really hard and bruised his kidney. And that basically caused the WWF to pass on him. Plus, Bret mentioned that he was pissed that Bruce took Owen's heat away at the end of the match because instead of Owen getting a big pop for pinning Austin, the crowd was more into Bruce's actions outside the ring. And one more thing is that during the celebration at the end of the match, a random kid joined them in the ring. Bret asked him who he was and the kid replied, "I just told them I was a Hart." Bret told him to stay in the ring and enjoy himself.
Huh.
What a great story.
Oh, Bruce.
I don't recall that from Bret's book, but that's I would not doubt that.
Brian Camacho, excellent pay-per-view by all means. The 10-man tag is by far one of the greatest matches in WWF history. The fact that it took place during one of the hottest angles in history makes this event worth watching. This one event tells you what a hot crowd can what a difference a hot crowd can make for those watching at home. I would give this pay-per-view a perfect 10 out of 10.
All right, and thanks to everybody for your feedback. Of course, you can leave feedback throughout the week for any of the shows that are going on, including our pay-per-view or event we review every week at reviewaway.com. And looking ahead to next week, Wei, what are you thinking of reviewing?
What is it? Are we 2 weeks away now from our 100th show?
I think today is show number 98.
Okay.
I believe.
Okay, well, let's continue on at least for one more week with our SummerSlam revisiting. And let's do SummerSlam 98, like one of our feedback participants suggested. SummerSlam 1998, featuring...
Steve Austin and The Undertaker.
Oh, sorry, I meant 89.
Oh, 89.
I got my numbers mixed up.
All right.
Steve, SummerSlam 1989. There you go. It's featuring Hulk Hogan and Brutus Beefcake taking on Randy Savage and Zeus. Or did we review this already?
Have we?
No, I don't think so. We reviewed No Holds Barred, didn't we?
Okay. Zeus. Never a bad week when you get to review a Zeus match, everyone. So that's going to be coming up next week, SummerSlam 1989. We're going to be back Monday night with Review a Raw live and hopefully minimal issues, technically speaking.
Hopefully. And if there are any issues, well, enjoy them. Enjoy these issues. And just.
And we will be up at midnight Eastern on Monday night. And then, of course, Review and Impact is coming up later this week as we return after a week off. I can say, Wei, I did not miss Impact at all this past week.
You did not. Wow. There's so much to talk about. How did you not miss it?
I don't know. Somehow I just did. Just out of sight, out of mind.
Okay.
So that's coming up this Sunday on The Law. We'll be joined by, we are tentatively scheduled to be joined by ROH champion Davey Richards. And we're also going to hear my chat with Melina, which Wei was present for. And those interviews will also be making their way onto the Fight Network leading into SummerSlam, along with the John Morrison interview we did. So all of that is coming up. Stay tuned to liveaudiowrestling.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Law Radio or follow Wei at Wei0937, because he's always looking for more followers.
I'm not.
And
no,
the
I'm
more
not.
Followers he gets, the more guilt will mount that he never uses Twitter. So that is all coming up, everybody. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll chat with you next week. And we'll go out here with a song. This song was extremely popular in 1997. Right around the time of In Your House Canadian Stampede.
What's it called?
Well, let's listen to it.
Okay.